What concerns you right here and right now is what they do.
They kill people, Dominic said immediately. The words came out seemingly of their own accord.
Why do you think that?
Alexander asked innocently. The outfit is small. We're the only people here, judging by the parking pad outside. I'm not experienced enough to be an expert agent. All I did was whack somebody who needed it. And next day I'm up in headquarters talking to an assistant director, and a couple of days after that I drive to D.C. and get sent down here. This place is very, very special, very, very small, and it has top-level approval for whatever it does. You're not selling U.S. savings bonds here, are you?
The book on you is that you have good analytical ability, Alexander said. Can you learn to keep your mouth shut?
It's not needed in this particular place, I should think. But yeah, I know how. When the situation calls for it, Dominic said.
Okay, here's the first speech. You guys know what black means, right? It means a program or a project that is not acknowledged by the government. People pretend it doesn't exist. The campus takes that one step further. We really do not exist. There is not a single written document in the possession of any government employee that has a single word about us. From this moment on, you two gentlemen do not exist.
Oh, sure, you, Captain, or is it Major already, Caruso, you get a paycheck that's going to be direct deposited into whatever bank account you set up this week, but you are no longer a Marine. You are on detached duty, whose nature is unknown. And you, Special Agent Dominic Caruso,
I know, Gus Werner told me. They dug a hole and pulled it in after them.
Alexander nodded.
You will both leave your official identification documents, dog tags, everything here before you leave. You can keep your names, maybe, but a name is just a couple of words, and nobody believes a name in this business anyway. That's the funny part about my time in the field with the agency. Once on a job, I changed names without thinking about it. Damned embarrassing when I realized it. Like an actor. All of a sudden, I'm Macbeth when I'm supposed to be Hamlet. No harm came of it, though, and I didn't croak at the end of the play.
What exactly will we be doing? This was Brian.
Mostly you'll be doing investigative work, tracking money. The campus is particularly good at that. You'll find out how and why later. You will probably deploy together. You, Dominic, will do most of the heavy lifting on the investigative side. You, Brian, will back him up on the muscle side. And along the way, you'll learn to do what...
What was it you called him a little while ago?
Oh, you mean Enzo. I call him that because he had a heavy foot when he got his driver's license. You know, like Enzo Ferrari.
Dominic pointed to his brother and laughed.
He's Aldo because he dresses like a dweeb. Like in that wine commercial, Aldo Cella. He's not a slave to fashion.
It's a family joke.
Okay, go to Brooks Brothers and dress better, Pete Alexander told Brian. Your cover will mainly be as a businessman or a tourist, so you'll have to dress neatly, but not like the Prince of Wales. You'll both let your hair grow out, especially you, Aldo.
Brian rubbed a hand over his head stubble. It marked him anywhere in the civilized world as a United States Marine.
It could have been worse. Army Rangers were even more radical in the hair department.
Brian would look like a fairly normal human being in a month or so.
Damn! I'll have to buy a comb.
What's the plan?
For today, just relax and settle in. Tomorrow we wake up early and make sure you two are in decent physical shape. Then there's weapons proficiency and the sit-down classwork. You're both computer literate, I presume.
Why do you ask? This was Brian.
The campus mainly works like a virtual office. You'll be issued computers with built-in modems, and that's how you'll communicate with the home office.
What about security? Dominic asked.
The machines have pretty good security built in. If there's a way to crack them, nobody's found it yet.
That's good to know. Enzo observed dubiously.
They use computers in the core, Aldo?
Yeah. We have all the modern conveniences, even toilet paper. And your name is Mohammed? Ernesto asked. That is correct, but for now, call me Miguel. Unlike with Nigel, it was a name he'd be able to remember. He had not begun by invoking Allah's blessing on this meeting. These unbelievers would not have understood.
Your English is... well, you sound English.
I was educated there, Muhammad explained. My mother was English, my father was Saudi.
Was?
Both are dead.
My sympathies, Ernesto offered with questionable sincerity. So, what can we do for each other?
I told Pablo here about the idea. Has he filled you in?
Si. He has. But I wish to hear it directly from you. You understand that I represent six others who share my business interests.
I see. Do you have the power to negotiate for all of them?
Not entirely. But I will present what you say to them. You need not meet with them all, and they have never rejected my suggestions. If we come to an agreement here, it can be fully ratified by the end of the week.
Very well. You know the interests I myself represent. I am empowered to make an agreement as well. Like you, we have a major enemy nation to the north. They are putting ever greater pressure on my friends. We wish to retaliate and to deflect their pressure in other directions.
It is much the same with us, Ernesto observed. Therefore, it is in our mutual interests to cause unrest and chaos within America.
The new American president is a weak man, but for that reason he can be a dangerous one. The weak are quicker to use force than the strong. Even though they use it inefficiently, it can be an annoyance.
Their methods of intelligence gathering concern us.
You also?
We have learned caution, Mohammed replied.
What we do not have is a good infrastructure in America. For this, we need assistance.
You don't? That's surprising. Their news media is full of reports about the FBI and other agencies busily tracking your people within their borders.
At the moment, they are chasing shadows and sowing discord in their own land by doing so. It complicates the task of building a proper network so that we can conduct offensive operations.
The nature of those operations does not concern us? Pablo asked.
That is correct. It is nothing you have not done yourselves, of course.
But not in America, he did not add.
Here in Colombia, the gloves were all the way off, but they've been careful to limit themselves in the U.S., their customer nation. So much the better. It would be entirely out of character with anything they'd done. Operational security was a concept both sides fully understood.
I see, the senior cartel man noted.
He was no fool. Mohammed could see that in his eyes. The Arab was not going to underestimate these men or their capabilities. Nor would he mistake them for friends. They could be as ruthless as his own men, he knew that. Those who denied God could be every bit as dangerous as those who worked in his name.
So, what can you offer us?
We have conducted operations in Europe for a long time, said Mohammed. You wish to expand your marketing efforts there. We've had a highly secure network in place for over 20 years. The changes in European commerce, the diminution of the importance of borders and so forth, works in your favor, as it has worked in ours. We have a cell in the port city of Piraeus that can easily accommodate your needs, and contacts within the transnational trucking companies. If they can transport weapons and people for us, they can surely transport your products easily enough.
We will need a list of names, the people with whom we can discuss the technical aspects of this business, Ernesto told his guest.
I have it with me. Mohammed held up his personal laptop computer. They are accustomed to doing business in return for monetary considerations. He saw his host nod without asking about how much money. Clearly this was not a matter of great concern for them. Ernesto and Pablo were thinking. There were over 300 million people in Europe, and many of them would doubtless enjoy the Colombian's cocaine. Some European countries even allowed the use of drugs in discreet, controlled, and taxed settings. The money involved was insufficient to make a decent profit, but it did have the advantage of setting the proper atmosphere, and nothing, not even medicinal quality heroin, was as good as Andean coca. For that, they would pay their euros, and this time it would be enough to make this venture profitable. The danger, of course, was in the distribution side. Some careless street dealers would undoubtedly be arrested, and some of them would talk. So, there had to be ample insulation between the wholesale distribution and retail sides, but that was something they knew how to do. No matter how professional the European policemen were, they could not be all that different from the Americans. Some of them would even happily take the cartel's euros and grease the skids. Business was business. And if this Arab could help with that, for free, which was truly remarkable, so much the better. Ernesto and Pablo did not react physically to the business offer on the table. An outsider might have taken their demeanor for boredom. It was anything but that, of course. This offer was heaven sent. A whole new market was going to open up, and with the new revenue stream it brought, maybe they could buy their country entirely. They'd have to learn a new way of doing business, but they'd have the money to experiment, and they were adaptable creatures. Fish, as it were, swimming in a sea of peasants and capitalists. "How do we contact these people?" Pablo inquired. "My people will make the necessary introductions." Better and better, Ernesto thought. "And what services will you require of us?" he finally asked. "We will need your help to transport people into America. How would we go about this?" "If you mean physically moving people from your part of the world into America, the best thing is to fly them into Colombia. Right here to Cartagena, in fact. Then we will arrange for them to be flown into other Spanish-speaking countries to the north. Costa Rica, for example. From there, if they have reliable travel documents, they can fly there directly, via an American airline or through Mexico. If they appear Latin and speak Spanish, they can be smuggled across the Mexican-American border. It is a physical challenge, and some of them might be apprehended, but if so, they'd simply be returned to Mexico for another attempt. Or again, with proper documents, we could just walk across the border into San Diego, California. Once in America, it's a question of maintaining your cover. If money is not an issue..." "It isn't," Mohammed assured him. "Then you retain a local attorney. Few of them have much in the way of scruples, and arrange the purchase of a suitable safe house to serve as a base of operations. Forgive me, I know we agreed that such operations need not concern us, but if you gave me some idea of what you have in mind, I could advise you." Mohammed thought for a few moments and then explained. "I see. Your people must be properly motivated to do such things," Ernesto observed. "They are." Could this man have any doubt of that? Mohammed wondered. "And with good planning and nerve, they can even survive. But you must never underestimate the American police agencies. In our business, we can make financial arrangements with some of them, but that is very unlikely in your case." "We understand that. Ideally, we would want our people to survive, but sadly we know that some will be lost. They understand the risk." He didn't talk about paradise. These people would not understand. The god they worshipped folded into their wallets. "What sort of fanatic throws his people away like that?" Pablo asked himself. "His men freely took their risks, measuring the money to be gained against the consequences of failure, and made decisions out of their own free will. Not these people." "Well, one couldn't always choose one's business associates." "Very well. We have a number of blank American passports. It is your job to be certain that the people you send us can speak proper English or Spanish, and can present themselves properly.
I trust none of them will partake in flying lessons?
Ernesto meant it as a joke. Muhammad did not take it as one.
The time for that is past. Success rarely succeeds twice in my field of endeavor.
Fortunately, we have a different field, Ernesto responded.
And it was true. He could send shipments and cargo container boxes via commercial vessels and trucks all over America. If one of them was lost and the program destination discovered, America had many legal protections for his downstream employees. Only the foolish ones went to prison. Over the years, they'd learned to defeat sniffer dogs and all the other means of discovery. The most important thing was that they used people who were willing to take risks, and most of them survived to retire back to Colombia and join the upper middle class, their prosperity the result of something in the distant, fading past, never to be repeated or spoken of.
So, Muhammad said, when can we commence operations?
This man is anxious, Ernesto noted, but he would accommodate him. Whatever he managed to accomplish would draw manpower away from America's counter-smuggling operations, and that was good. The relatively minor cross-border losses he had learned to endure would shrink to even more trivial levels. The street price of cocaine would drop, but demand would increase somewhat, and so there would be no net loss in sales revenue. That would be the tactical profit. More to the point, America would become less interested in Colombia and shift her focus of intelligence operations elsewhere. That would be his strategic advantage from this endeavor.
And he always had the option of sending the information to the CIA. Terrorists had appeared unexpectedly in his backyard, he could say, and their operations would be understood to be beyond the pale even for the cartel. While that would not gain him the affection of America, it would not hurt him either. And any of his own people who'd provided assistance to the terrorists could be dealt with internally, as it were. The Americans would actually respect that. So there was a real upside and a controllable downside. On the whole, he decided, this had the makings of a valuable and profitable operation.
Señor Miguel, I will propose this alliance to my colleagues, with my recommendation that we undertake it. You can expect the final decision by the end of this week. Will you remain in Cartagena, or will you be traveling?
I prefer not to remain in one place too long. I fly out tomorrow.
Pablo can reach me via the internet with your decision. For the moment, I thank you for a cordial business meeting.
Ernesto stood and took his guest's hand. He decided then and there to consider Miguel as a businessman in a similar but not competitive field of endeavor, not a friend, certainly, but an ally of convenience.
How the hell did you manage this? Jack asked.
Ever hear of a company called InfoSec? Rick Bell asked in return.
Encryption stuff, right?
Correct. Information Systems Security Company. The company's domiciled outside of Seattle. They have the best information security program there is, headed by a former deputy head of the Z Division over at Fort Meade. He and three colleagues set the company up about 9 years ago. I'm not sure NSA can crack it, short of brute forcing it with their new Sun workstations. Just about every bank in the world uses it, especially the ones in Liechtenstein and the rest of Europe. But there's a trap door in the program.
And nobody's found it?
Buyers of computer programs had learned over the years to have outside experts go over such programs line by line as a defense against playful software engineers, of which there were far too many.
Those NSA guys do good code, Bell responded. I have no idea what's in there, but these guys still have their old NSA school ties hanging in the closet, you know?
And Fort Meade listens in, and we get what they dig up when they fax it to Langley, Jack said.
Anybody at CIA good at tracking money?
Not as good as our people.
Takes a thief to catch a thief, eh?
Helps to know the mindset of the adversary, Bell confirmed. It's not a large community we're dealing with here. Hell, we know most of them. We're in the same business, right?
And that makes me an additional asset, Jack asked.
He was not a prince under American law, but Europeans still thought in such terms. They'd bow and scrape just to shake his hand, regard him as a promising young man, however thick his head might turn out to be, and seek his favor, first because of the possibility he might speak a kind word into the right ear. It was called corruption, of course, or at least the atmosphere for it.
"What did you learn in the White House?"
Bell asked.
"A little, I suppose," Jack responded.
Mostly he'd learned things from Mike Brennan, who'd cordially detested all the diplomatic fol-de-rol, to say nothing of the political stuff that happened there every day. Brennan had talked it over with his foreign colleagues often enough, who saw the same things in their own capitals, and who thought much the same of it, from behind the same blank faces when they stood post. It was probably a better way to learn all this stuff than his father had, Jack thought. He hadn't been forced to learn to swim while struggling not to drown. It was something his father had never spoken about, except when angry at the whole corrupting process.
"Be careful talking to Jerry about it," said Bell. "He likes to say how clean and upright the trading business is by comparison."
"Dad really likes the guy. I guess maybe they're a little alike."
"No," Bell corrected. "They're a lot alike."
"Hendley got out of politics because of the accident, right?"
Bell nodded.
"That's it. Wait until you have a wife and kids. It's about the biggest hit a man can take, even worse than you might think. He had to go and identify the bodies. It wasn't pretty. Some people would eat a gun after that, but he didn't. He'd been thinking about a run for the White House himself. Thought maybe Wendy would make a good first lady. Maybe so. But his lust for that job died along with his wife and kids."
He didn't go further. The senior people at the campus protected the boss, in reputation at least. They thought him a man who deserved loyalty. There was no considered line of succession at the campus. Nobody had thought that far forward, and the subject never came up in board meetings. They were mainly concerned with non-business matters anyway. He wondered if John Patrick Ryan Jr. would take note of that one blank spot in the makeup of the campus.
"So," Bell went on, "what do you think so far?"
"I read the transcripts they gave me of what the central bank heads say back and forth to each other. It's surprising how venal some of that stuff is."
Jack paused.
"Oh, yeah. Shouldn't be surprised, should I?" "Anytime you give people control of that much money or power, some corruption is bound to happen. What surprises me is the way their friendships cross national lines. A lot of these guys profit personally when their own currencies are hurt, even if it means a little inconvenience for their fellow citizens. Back in the old days, the nobility frequently felt more at ease with foreign nobility than with the people on their own estates who bowed down to the same king. That characteristic hasn't died yet, at least not over there. Here, the big industrialists might work together to lobby Congress, but they don't often hand freebies to them, and they don't trade secrets. Conspiracy at that level isn't impossible, but concealing it for a long time is pretty tough. Too many people, and everyone has a mouth. Europe's getting the same way. There's nothing the media likes better than a scandal, here or there, and they'd rather clobber a rich crook than a cabinet minister. The latter is often a good source, after all. The former is just a crook.
So how do you keep your people honest?"
It was a good question, Bell thought, and one they worried about all the time, though it wasn't spoken about much. "We pay our people pretty well, and everyone here is part of a group investment plan that makes them feel comfortable. The annualized return is about 19% over the last few years."
"That's not bad," Junior understated. "All within the law?"
"That depends on the lawyer you talk to, but no U.S. attorney is going to make a big deal about it, and we're very careful how we manage it. We don't like greed here. We could turn this place into the biggest thing since Ponzi, but then people would notice. So we don't flaunt anything. We make enough to cover our operations and to make sure the troops are well provided for."
They also kept track of the employees' money and the trades they made, if any. Most didn't, though some worked accounts through the office, which again was profitable but not greedy.
"You'll give us account numbers and codes to all of your personal finances, and the computers will keep track of them."
I have a trust account through Dad, but it's managed through an accounting firm in New York. I get a nice allowance, but no access to the principal. What I make on my own is mine alone, however, unless I send it to the CPAs. Then they build it up and send me a statement every quarter. When I turn 30, I'm allowed to play with it on my own. Turning 30 was a little distant for young Jack to concern himself about at the moment, however. We know, Bell assured him. It's not a question of lack of trust. It's just that we want to make sure nobody's developed a gambling habit. Probably the best mathematicians of all time were the ones who'd made up the rules for gambling games, Bell thought. They'd provided just enough illusion that you had a chance to sucker you in. Born inside the human mind was the most dangerous of drugs. That was called ego, too. So, I start out on the white side of the house, watching currency fluctuations and stuff, said Jack. Bell nodded. Correct. You need to learn the language first. Fair enough. His father had started off a lot more humbly than this, as a junior accounting manager at Merrill Lynch who'd had to cold call people. Paying one's dues was probably bad for the ego, but good for the soul. His father had often lectured him on the virtue of patience. He'd said that it was a pain in the ass to acquire, even after acquiring it. But the game had rules, even in this place. Especially in this place, Jack realized on reflection. He wondered what happened to people on the campus who crossed over the line. Probably nothing good. Buon vino, Dominic observed. For a government installation, the wine cellar isn't half bad. The year on the bottle read 1962, long before he and his brother had been born. For that matter, so long ago their mom had just been thinking about Mercy High School, a few blocks from their grandparents' place on Lock Raven Boulevard in Baltimore. Toward the end of the last ice age, probably. But Baltimore was a hell of a long way from the Seattle they'd grown up in. How old is this place? He asked Alexander. The property? It goes back to before the Civil War. The house was started in 17-something, burned down and rebuilt in 1882. Government got hold of it just before Nixon was elected. The owner was an old OSS guy, J. Donald Hamilton, worked with Donovan and his crowd. He got a fair price when he sold it, moved out to New Mexico, and died there in 1986, I think, aged 94. They say he was a mover and shaker in his day, stuck it out pretty far in World War I, and helped Wild Bill work against the Nazis. There's a painting of him in the library. Looks like a guy to step aside for. And yeah, he did know his wines. This one's from Tuscany. Goes nicely with veal, Brian said. He'd done the cooking. This veal goes well with anything. You didn't learn that in the Marine Corps, Alexander observed. From Pop. He is a better cook than Mom, Dominic explained. You know it's an old country thing. And Grandpop, that son of a bitch, can still do it too. He's what, Aldo, 82? Last month, Brian confirmed. Funny old guy. Travels the whole world to get to Seattle, and then he never leaves the city for 60 years. Same house for the last 40, Dominic added, a block from the restaurant. This his recipe for the veal? Bet your bippy, Pete. The family goes back to Florence. Went up there 2 years ago when the Med FMF was making a port call in Naples. His cousin has a restaurant just upriver from the Ponte Vecchio. When they found out who I was, they went nuts feeding me. You know, Italians love the Marines. Must be the green suit, Aldo, Dominic said. Maybe I just cut a manly figure, Enzo. Ever think of that? Captain Caruso demanded. Oh, sure, Special Agent Caruso replied, taking another bite of the veal francese. The next Rocky sits before us. You boys always like this? Alexander asked. Just when we drink, Dominic replied, and his brother laughed. Enzo can't hold his liquor worth a damn. Now we Marines, we can do anything. I have to take this from somebody who thinks Miller Lite is really beer? The FBI Caruso asked the air. You know, Alexander said, "Twins are supposed to be alike."
"Only identical twins. Mom punched out 2 eggs that month. It had Mom and Dad fooled until we were a year old or so. We're not at all alike, Pete." Dominic delivered this pronouncement with a smile shared by his brother. But Alexander knew better. They only dressed differently. And that would soon be changing. Chapter 5. Alliances.
Mohammed took the first Avianca flight to Mexico City, and there he waited for British Airways Flight 242 to London. He felt safe in airports, where everything was anonymous. He had to be careful of the food, since Mexico was a nation of unbelievers, but the first-class lounge protected him from their cultural barbarism, and the many armed police officers ensured that people rather like himself did not crash the party, such as it was. So, he picked a corner seat away from the windows and read a book he'd picked up in one of the shops, and managed not to be bored to death. He never read the Quran in such a place, of course, nor anything about the Middle East, lest someone ask him a question. No, he had to live his cover legend as well as any professional intelligence officer, so that he did not come to an end as abrupt as the Jew Greengold in Rome. Mohammed even used the bathroom facilities carefully, in case someone tried the same trick on him. He didn't even make use of his laptop computer, though there was ample opportunity to do so. Better, he judged, to sit still like a lump. In 24 hours he'd be back on the European mainland. It hit him that he lived in the air more than anywhere else. He had no home, just a series of safe houses, which were places of dubious reliability. Saudi Arabia was closed to him, and had been for nearly 5 years. Afghanistan was similarly out of bounds. How strange that the only lands where he could feel something close to safe were the Christian countries of Europe, which Muslims had struggled and failed to conquer on more than one occasion. Those nations had nearly suicidal openness to strangers, and one could disappear in their vastness with only modest skills. Hardly any, in fact, if you had money. These people were so self-destructively open, so afraid to offend those who would just as soon see them and their children dead and their entire cultures destroyed. It was a pleasing vision, Mohammed thought. But he didn't live within dreams. Instead, he worked for them. This struggle would last longer than his lifetime. Sad, perhaps, but true. But it was better to serve a cause than one's own interests. There were enough of those in the world. He wondered what his supposed allies from yesterday's meeting were saying and thinking. They were certainly not true allies. Oh, yes, they shared enemies, but that was not the summation of an alliance. They would, might, facilitate matters, but no more than that. Their men would not assist his men in any real endeavor. Throughout history, mercenaries had never really been effective soldiers. To fight effectively, you had to believe. Only a believer would risk his life, because only a believer had nothing to fear. Not with Allah himself on his side. What was there to fear, then? Only one thing, he admitted to himself, failure. Failure was not an option. The obstacles between him and success were things to be dealt with in any way that was convenient. Just things. Not people. Not souls. Mohammed fished a cigarette out of his pocket and lit it. In this sense, at least, Mexico was a civilized country, though he refused to speculate on what the Prophet would have said about tobacco. Easier in a car, isn't it, Enzo? Brian teased his brother as they crossed the finish line. The 3-mile run wasn't a big deal for the Marine, but for Dominic, who had just maxed out his PT test for the FBI, it had been a bit of a stretch.
"Look, Turkey," Dominic gasped out, "I just have to run faster than my subjects. Afghanistan would have killed your ass."
Brian was running backward now, the better to observe his struggling brother.
"Probably," Dominic admitted.
But Afghans don't rob banks in Alabama and New Jersey. Dominic had never in his life traded toughness to his brother, but clearly the Marines had made him maintain greater fitness than the FBI did. But how good was he with a pistol? At last it was over, and he walked back toward the plantation house. "Do we pass?" Brian asked Alexander on the way in. "Easy, both of you. This isn't Ranger School, guys. We don't expect you to try out for the Olympics team, but out in the field, running away is a nice ability to have." "At Quantico, Gunny Honey liked to say that," Brian agreed.
"Who?" Dominic asked.
"Nicholas Honey, Master Gunnery Sergeant, United States Marine Corps, and yeah, he probably took a lot of razzing because of his name, but probably not from the same guy twice. He was one of the instructors at the basic school. They also called him Nick the Prick," Brian said, grabbing a towel and tossing it to his brother. "He's one badass Marine, but he said that running away is the one skill an infantryman needs."
"Did you?" Dominic asked.
"I've only seen combat once, and that was just for a couple of months. Mostly we were looking down at mountain goats who had heart attacks from climbing those fucking hills."
"That bad, eh?"
"Worse," Alexander joined in. "But fighting wars is for kids, not sensible adults. You see, Agent Caruso, out in the weeds you also wear 65 pounds on your back."
"That must be fun," Dominic said to his brother, not without respect.
"Big time. Okay, Pete, what other pleasant things are on the plan of the day?"
"Get cleaned up first," Alexander advised. Now that he was certain that both were in reasonable physical shape, though he'd had little doubt of that, and it wasn't all that important anyway, despite what he'd said, they could look into the hard stuff. The important stuff.
"The buck is going to take a hit," Jack told his new boss.
"How bad?"
"Just a scratch. The Germans are going to short the dollar against the euro, about 500 million worth."
"Is that a big deal?" Sam Granger asked.
"You're asking me?" Jack responded.
"That's right. You have to have an opinion. It doesn't have to be correct, but it has to make some kind of sense."
Jack Ryan Jr. handed over the intercepts. "This guy Dieter's talking with his French counterpart. He makes it sound like a routine transaction, but the translator says the tone of his voice has some nastiness to it. I speak a little German, but not well enough for that sort of nuance," the young Ryan told his boss. "I cannot say that I understand why the Germans and French would be in any sort of conspiracy against us."
"It suits current German interests to cozy up to the French. I do not see a long-term bilateral alliance of any sort, however. Fundamentally, the French are afraid of the Germans, and the Germans look down on the French. But the French have imperial ambitions. Well, they always have. Look at their relations with America. Kind of like brother and sister, age 12 or so. They love each other, but they can't get along very well. Germany and France, that's similar but more complex. The French used to kick their ass, but then the Germans got organized and kicked the French ass. And both countries have long memories. That's the curse of Europe. There's a lot of contentious history over there, and they have trouble forgetting it."
"What does that have to do with this?" the young Ryan asked.
"Directly, nothing at all. But as background, maybe the German banker wants to get close to this guy to make a future play. Maybe the Frenchman is letting him think he's getting close so that the French central bank can score points on Berlin. This is a funny game. You can't clobber your adversary too hard because then he won't play with you anymore. And besides that, you don't go out of your way to make enemies. All in all, it's like a neighborhood poker game. If you do too well, then you make enemies. And it's a lot less fun to live there because nobody will come over to your house to play. If you're the dumbest at the table, the others will gang up on you in the nicest possible way and steal from you. Not enough to hurt you, but enough to tell themselves how smart they are. So what happens is that everyone plays a touch under his game, and it stays fairly friendly. Nobody over there is any farther than a general strike away from a major national liquidity crisis. And when that happens, you need friends."
I forgot to tell you, the central bankers regard everyone else on the continent as peasants. That can include the heads of the various governments.
And us?
Americans? Oh, yeah. Meanly born, poorly educated, but exceedingly lucky peasants.
With big guns? Little Jack asked.
Yeah. Peasants with guns always make the aristocracy nervous, Granger agreed, stifling a laugh. They still have that class crap over there. They have trouble understanding how badly it holds them back in the marketplace, because the big shots rarely come up with a really new idea. But that's not our problem.
Oderint dum metuant, Jack thought. One of the few things he remembered from Latin. Supposedly the personal motto of the Emperor Gaius Caligula. Let them hate so long as they fear. Hadn't civilization advanced any further than that in the past 2 millennia?
What is our problem? He asked.
Granger shook his head. I didn't mean it that way. They don't like us much. They never have liked us, really. But at the same time, they can't live without us. Some of them are starting to think they can, after the death of the Soviet Union. But if they ever try, reality will bite them on the ass hard enough to draw blood. Don't confuse the thoughts of the aristocracy with those of the people. That's the problem with them. They really do think that people follow their lead, but they don't. They follow their own wallets. And the average guy in the street will figure things out all by himself if he has enough time to think it through. So, the campus just makes money off their fantasy world. You got it. You know, I hate soap operas. Do you know why I hate them? He got a blank look. Jack, it's because they reflect reality so precisely. Real life, even at this level, is full of petty bullshit and egos. It isn't love that makes the world go round. It isn't even money. It's bullshit.
Hey, I've heard cynicism in my time, but...
Granger cut him off with a raised hand.
Not cynicism. Human nature.
The one thing that hasn't changed in 10,000 years of recorded history. I wonder if it ever will.
Hey, I've heard cynicism in my time, but...
Granger cut him off with a raised hand.
Not cynicism. Human nature.
The one thing that hasn't changed in 10,000 years of recorded history. I wonder if it ever will.
Oh, sure, there's the good part of human nature, too. Nobility, charity, self-sacrifice, even courage in some cases.
And love.
Love counts.
It counts a lot. But along with it comes envy, covetousness, greed, all the 7 deadly sins. Maybe Jesus knew what he was talking about, eh?
Is this philosophy or theology?
I thought this was supposed to be the intelligence business, the young Ryan thought.
I turned 50 next week. Too soon old and too late smart.
Some cowboy said that 100 years or so ago.
Granger smiled.
Problem is, you're too damn old when you realize it to be able to do anything about it.
What would you do? Start a new religion?
Granger had himself a good laugh as he turned to refill his coffee cup from his personal Gevalia machine.
No, none of the bushes around my house burn.
The trouble with thinking deep thoughts is that you still have to cut the grass and put food on the table. And in our case, protect our country.
So what do we do about this German thing?
Granger gave the intercept another look and thought for a second.
Nothing. Not right now. But we remember that Dieter has earned a point or two with Claude, which he may cash in 6 months or so. The euro is still too new to see how it's going to play out. The French think that the financial leadership of Europe will slide to Paris. The Germans think it'll go to Berlin. In fact, it'll go to the country with the strongest economy, the most efficient workforce. That won't be France. They have pretty good engineers, but their population isn't as well organized as the Germans are. If I had to bet, I'd bet on Berlin. The French won't like that.
That's a fact, Jack. That's a fact, Granger repeated.
What the hell? The French have nukes and the Germans don't. For now, anyway.
You serious? The young Ryan demanded.
A smile. No.
They taught us some of that at Quantico, Dominic said. They were in a medium-sized shopping mall that catered to the college crowd due to the proximity of UVA.
What did they say? Brian asked.
Don't stay in the same place relative to your subject. Try to alter your appearance. Sunglasses like that. Wigs, if they're available. Reversible jackets. Don't stare at him, but don't turn away if he looks at you. It's a lot better if it's more than one agent on a target. One man can't track a trained adversary for very long without being made. A trained subject is hard to tail under the best of circumstances. That's why the big offices have the SSGs, Special Surveillance Groups. They're FBI employees, but they're not sworn, and they don't carry guns. Some guys call them the Baker Street Irregulars, as in Sherlock Holmes. They look like anything except a cop. Street people, bums, workers in coveralls. They can be dirty. They can be panhandlers. I met some at the New York City field office once. They work OC and FCI, organized crime and foreign counterintelligence. They're pros, but they're the most unlikely-looking damn pros you ever want to meet.
Hard-working people like that? Brian asked his brother. Surveillance, I mean?
Never tried it myself, but from what I've heard, it takes a lot of manpower, like 15 or 20, to work one subject, plus cars, plus aircraft, and a really good bad guy can outfox us even then. The Russians, especially. Those bastards are trained pretty well.
So, what the hell are we supposed to do? Captain Caruso asked.
Just learn the basics, Alexander told them. See the woman over there with the red sweater?
Long dark hair, Brian asked.
That's the one, Pete confirmed.
Determine what she buys, what sort of car she drives, and where she lives.
Just the two of us? Dominic demanded.
You're not asking much, are you?
Did I tell you this was easy work? Alexander asked innocently.
He handed over two radios. The earpieces go in your ears, the microphones clip to your collars. Range is about 3 kilometers. You both have your car keys. And with that, he walked away toward an Eddie Bauer store to buy himself a pair of shorts.
"Welcome to the shit, Enzo," Brian said. "At least he gave us a mission brief.
It was brief, all right."
Their subject had walked into an Ann Taylor store. They both headed down that way, each getting a large cup of coffee at the Starbucks as a jackleg disguise.
"Don't throw the cup away," Dominic told his brother.
"Why?"
Brian asked.
"In case you gotta take a piss."
The perversity of the world is a way of impinging on your carefully made plans in situations like this. That's a practical lesson from a class at the academy.
Brian didn't comment, but it seemed sensible enough.
One at a time, they donned their radios and made sure they worked properly.
Aldo to Enzo, over, Brian called on Channel 6.
Enzo copies, bro.
Let's switch off on visual surveillance, but we'll stay within sight of each other. Okay?
Makes sense.
Okay, I'll head toward the store.
10-4.
That's Roger to you, bro.
Dominic turned to see his brother draw off. Then he settled down to sipping his coffee and looking off the subject, never directly at her, but about 20 degrees to the side.
What's she up to? Aldo asked.
Picking a blouse, looks like. The subject was 30 or so, with shoulder-length brown hair, fairly attractive, wearing a wedding band but no diamond, and a cheap gold-colored necklace probably purchased at Walmart on the other side of the road. Peach-colored blouse, shirt, pants rather than a skirt, black in color, black, flat, sensible shoes, fairly large purse. Did not appear overly alert to her surroundings, which was good. She appeared to be alone.
She finally settled on a blouse, white silk by the look of it, paid for it with a credit card, and walked out of Ann Taylor. "Subject is moving, Aldo." 70 yards away, Brian's head perked up and turned directly toward his brother. "Talk to me, Enzo." Dominic raised his coffee cup as though to take a drink. "Turning left, coming your way. You can take over in a minute or so." 10-4, Enzo." They'd parked their cars on opposite sides of the shopping mall. That turned out to be a good thing, as their subject turned right and headed for the door out to the parking lot. "Aldo, get close enough to make her tag," Dominic ordered.
"What?"
"Read her tag number to me and describe the car. I'm heading for my car."
"Okay, roger that, bro."
Dominic didn't run to his car, but he walked as fast as circumstances allowed. He got in, started the engine, and lowered all his windows. "Enzo to Aldo, over."
"Okay. She's driving a dark green Volvo station wagon, Virginia tag, Whiskey Kilo Romeo 619er. Alone in the car, starting up, turning north. I'm on the way to my wheels."
"Roger that. Enzo is in pursuit." He got around the Sears department store that anchored the east end of the mall as quickly as traffic allowed, and reached in his coat pocket for his cell phone, and called information to get the number of the Charlottesville FBI office, which the phone company dialed for him for an additional charge of 50 cents.
"Heads up, this is Special Agent Dominic Caruso. My credo number is 165821. I need a tag number run right now. Whiskey Kilo Romeo 619er.
Whoever was on the other end of the phone typed his credentials number into a computer and verified Dominic's identity.
"What are you doing this far from Birmingham, Mr. Caruso?"
"No time for that. Please run the tag."
"Roger, okay. It's a Volvo, green in color, a year old, registered to Edward and Michelle Peters, at 6 Riding Hood Court, Charlottesville. That's just inside the city line on the west side of town. Anything else? Do you need backup?"
"Negative. Thank you. I can handle it from here. Caruso out." He killed his cell phone and relayed the address to his brother over the radio. Both then did the same thing and entered the address into their navigation computers.
"This is cheating," Brian observed, smiling as he did so.
"Good guys don't cheat, Aldo. They just get the job done."
"Okay, I have eyeballs on the subject. She's heading west on Shady Branch Road. Where are you?"
"About 500 yards back of you."
"Shit! I have a red light."
"Okay, sit it out. Looks like she's heading home, and we know where that is." Dominic closed his target to within 100 yards, keeping a pickup truck between himself and the subject car. He'd rarely done this sort of thing before, and he was surprised at how tense it was.
"Prepare to turn right in 500 feet, the computer told him.
"Thanks, honey," Dominic grumbled. But then the Volvo turned at the corner suggested by the computer. So, it wasn't so bad after all, was it? Dominic took a breath and settled down some.
"Okay, Brian, looks like she's going right home. Just follow me in," he said over the radio.
"Roger, following you in. Any idea who this broad is?"
"Michelle Peters, so says the DMV. The Volvo turned left, then right, into a cul-de-sac, where it pulled into a driveway that ended at a two-car garage attached to a medium-sized house of 2 stories and white aluminum siding. He parked his car 100 yards up the street and took a sip of his coffee. Brian showed up 30 seconds later, doing the same half a block up.
"See the car?" Dominic called.
"That's affirmative, Enzo." The Marine paused.
"Now what do we do?"
"You come on down for a cup of my coffee," a female voice suggested.
"I'm the broad in the Volvo," the voice clarified.
"Oh, shit," Dominic whispered away from the microphone. He got out of his Mercedes and waved to his brother to do the same. Upon joining up, the Caruso brothers walked to 6 Riding Hood Court. The door opened as they came up the driveway.
"Set up all the way," Dominic said quietly. "Should have figured that one out from the beginning."
"Yep. Colorist dumb," Brian thought.
"Not really," Mrs. Peters said from the door. "But getting my address from the DMV really was cheating, you know." Nobody told us anything about rules, ma'am, Dominic told her. There aren't any. Not very often, anyway, not in this business.
So you listened in on the radio circuit the whole time? Brian asked.
She nodded as she led them to the kitchen. That's right. The radios are encrypted. Nobody else knew what you were talking about. How do you boys like your coffee?
So you spotted us all the way? This was Dominic.
Actually, no. I didn't use the radios to cheat. Well, not all that much. She had an engaging smile, which helped to soften the blows to her visitors' egos. You're Enzo, right?
Yes, ma'am.
You were a little close, but only a really sharp-eyed target would have noticed, given the limited time frame. The make of the car helped. A lot of those little Benzes in this area. But the best choice of car would be a pickup. A dirty one. A lot of the yokels never washed them, and some of the academics at the school have adopted the same sort of behavior to fit in, like, out on Interstate 64, well, you'd better have an aircraft, of course, and a porta-potty. Discreet surveillance can be the toughest job in the business. But now you boys know that.
Then the door opened and Pete Alexander came in.
How'd they do? He asked Michelle.
I'll give them a B.
And suddenly Dominic thought that was generous.
And forget what I said before. Calling the FBI to get a DMV on me was pretty smart.
Not cheating? Brian asked.
Alexander took that one. The only rule is to accomplish the mission without being compromised. We don't tally up style points at the campus.
Just body count, Mrs. Peters confirmed, to Alexander's evident annoyance.
That was enough to make Brian's stomach contract a little.
Guys, I know I've asked it before, but what exactly are we training for?
Dominic leaned in visibly as well.
Patience, fellas, Pete cautioned.
Okay, Dominic nodded submission. I'll give you that this time.
But not too much longer, he didn't have to add.
So, you're not going to exploit this? Jack asked at closing time.
We could, but it's not really worth the time. We'd only turn a couple of hundred thousand at best, probably not that much. But you did okay spotting it, Granger allowed.
How much message traffic like this comes through here on a weekly basis?
One or two, four in a really busy week.
And how many plays do you make? Junior asked.
One in five? We do so carefully, but even so we always run the risk of being noticed. If the Europeans saw that we were outguessing them too much, then they'd look into how we were doing it. They'd probably shake down their own people looking for a human leaker. That's how they think over there. It's a big place for conspiracy theory, you see, because of the way they operate themselves. But the game they play regularly sort of militates against it.
What else do you look into?
Starting next week, you'll have access to the secure accounts. People call them the numbered accounts because they're supposedly identified by code numbers. Now it's mainly code words because of computer technology. They probably picked data from the intelligence community. They often hire spooks to look after their security, but not good ones. The good ones stay away from money management businesses, mainly out of snobbery.
It's not important enough for a senior spook, Granger explained.
The secured accounts, do they identify the owners? Jack asked.
Not always. Sometimes it's all done via code word, though sometimes the banks have internal memoranda that we can tap into.
Not always, though. And the bankers never speculate internally about their clients, at least not in written form. I'm sure they chat back and forth over lunch, but, you know, a lot of them, they really don't care very much about where the money comes from. Dead Jews in Auschwitz? Some mafia capo in Brooklyn? It's all money fresh off the presses.
But if you turn this over to the FBI,
we can't, because it's illegal. And we don't. Because then we'd lose a way to track the bastards and their money.
On the legal side, there's more than one jurisdiction, and for some of the European countries, well, banking is a big moneymaker, and no government ever turns its back on tax revenue. The dog doesn't bite anybody in